Hello, you are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show on Civic Media, broadcast statewide in the great state of Wisconsin, home of the Green Bay Packers, and one of those famous swing states that everybody who wants to be president and vice president will be spending a lot of time in for the next, 90 or so days until November. If you've been tuned into this radio station, you've probably been following political news. You know about the Democrats' presidential candidate, Kamala Harris. You know about the vice presidential candidate, Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota, who I'm told is a Vikings fan, but there is a picture of him going around on the internet of his classroom at Mankato West, where there is a Packer flag next to the TV, next to an assortment of bumper stickers. So Walz is at least Packer-adjacent, Wisconsin voters. Keep that in mind in November. He's also an accomplished defensive coordinator, led Mankato West to a Minnesota State Championship after 3 years after a winless season. He ran the 4-4 and just played run defense, had his linebackers watch the pulling guard, and they had three shutouts on their way to a state championship. Helped him get elected to Congress. Then he became governor, and now he's about to be vice president, in the opinion of the polls, and certainly in my hope that he is vice president and Kamala Harris is president. But a lot of people are talking, you know, about who they're running against. Of course, new extremes in divisiveness and authoritarianism and racism coming out of the Trump Vance ticket. And a lot of people are saying, is this ever happened before? And my guest is kind of an expert on what's happened before in America. So we're going to get to that. That'll be my opening question. But before I ask him any questions, let me introduce the listeners here. I think I already mentioned that I'm Nick Kovac, filling in for Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show that you're listening to. My guest is Professor Thomas Rowland of the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. How long were you at Oshkosh?
22, 23 years, 1998 to 2020.
And since 2020, you're happily retired in the Milwaukee area, in Milwaukee, city of Milwaukee?
Yes, yes. I had always been fascinated with Milwaukee, enjoyed it in the summer when I would come down and play softball and liked it a lot more, I'm afraid, than Oshkosh. So
no. Well, we do have Oshkosh listeners.
Okay, but no offense, Oshkosh.
But Milwaukee's happy to have you. I met you at my local watering hole, locally owned by actually Tim and Tony, who live upstairs now from the bar, Black Husky Bar. We met there, got to talking about some of your recent books. But before we get into before I start telling the listeners about your books, I mentioned that Governor Tim Walz, vice presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket, is Packer adjacent. You're more than just Packer adjacent. You didn't just show up in Oshkosh and jump on the bandwagon. You have a Packer connection that I think most Wisconsin natives would be jealous of. Your mother took classes in high school from Vince Lombardi at St. Cecilia.
Yes, that's right. In Englewood, New Jersey, suburban New York. Mm-hmm. Yes. And, she had a yearbook that Vince Lombardi signed off on. Mm-hmm. And as we were growing up as kids, I don't think my mother was that much into football, frankly, but she had an affinity for Vince Lombardi. And of course, he had become, by 1959, he had become
Packers coach. Yeah.
Yeah. Packers coach. Now, she was not able to convince my three brothers, who were devout New York Giant fans.
Well, and Vince had been the offensive coordinator on the Giants until 1958.
Yes. So there was that connection too, but I don't think my brothers had any cognizance of that. They were, they just were local.
Oh, it wasn't because of the Vince connection.
They
just root for the local team.
Yeah, they were. But my mom, I guess, convinced me. And so I would trace it back to about 1950, 1960 that I started rooting for them. Of course, there wasn't much by live TV. Yep. You didn't see them a lot, but I can remember a few radio broadcasts where in particular, I think it was 1962, the NFL championship, where the Packers beat the Giants in New York. Mm-hmm. And I was able to listen to it on a cold, frosty evening, watching my dad try to fix the leak in the kitchen sink. And I would hand him tools, but my ear was cocked towards the radio, and it was delightful. But that's the kind of connection. So, yeah.
All roads lead back to our vice presidential candidate, because one of the jokes about him is if he knocked on your door, you wouldn't be sure if he was asking for your vote or there to fix a leak in your kitchen.
He
gives off those blue collar vibes.
No, right? I know. No, he's very appealing that way. Yeah.
Do you also feel some comfort in the fact that the New York Giants are owned by oligarchs and the Packers are the people's team?
Well, yeah, there's that too.
Yes.
It's one of those rare phenomenon where it's not corporate owned, the Packers. It's run like a corporation.
Sure.
You know,
yeah,
there's no
yeah,
doubt
we call
about
it, we
that.
We call it socialism, but it's actually classic capitalism.
No,
it's
I
just
know.
A board of directors.
No, yeah, yeah.
But it's better than a single oligarch making all the decisions. There's accountability.
That's true. I agree.
And you have stockholders, and so it's a person-owned team. And Vince Lombardi, it was very sweet for him to beat the Giants for those first two championships because he wanted to be the New York Giants head coach.
Right.
And he later, I don't think he told David Marinus directly, they didn't overlap, but he was quoted in the great Marinus biography, When Pride Still Mattered, saying that someone on the Giants told him that they would never hire a head coach whose last name ended in a vowel.
I was just going to bring that up because Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Who was the owner back then?
Mara. Was it Wellington?
Oh, Wellington Mara. Yeah. He wasn't fond of that idea. And of course, Green Bay was in the 50s, was in the bowels of the
worst team
NFL.
In the league.
Yeah, right.
And
for a long time. So they were willing to take a chance with him. So.
And in fact, you know, everyone assumes that Vince was just given unilateral authority of all football operations. They just offered him the job. He went to the opening press conference and said, I have authority now. All football decisions go through me. And the board was like, oh, we didn't say that. But then he started winning, so they said fine.
Right, right.
I guess if you insist, you can have all the authority you want.
Yeah,
because that was part of the problem with the team in the 50s, that the local bankers and lawyers and real estate magnates, car ownership dealers were trying to run the football operation.
Oh.
And then it got back to that in the 70s. Anyway, enough Packer talk for now. We'll probably circle back at the end. I can't resist much. It is, you know, we do open the preseason tomorrow night in Cleveland. So it is officially Packer season, if preseason. Good luck. Glad that Jordan Love is locked down for the next 5 years. We got a great team, a lot of good new safeties.
Yes.
And football is a lot like politics sometimes. Some people even say it's sublimation for war. Maybe we'll get into that. But one of the reasons we had you on, not just to talk football, is that you're an extremely accomplished scholar of the 19th century, or what are the end posts for your expertise?
Well, I trace it, you know, at least from teaching and publishing points of view, it would span from 1848 through to 1920. And so it's a broad area that I publish within that section.
Yes. And speaking of the books you've published, you have three biographies of presidents. You started out in the 1850s with Millard Fillmore,
yes.
who he took over after, Taylor died, right?
Yes, exactly.
Never elected president, right?
No.
And that was the early 50s. Then you had Franklin Pierce. So you were kind of cornering the market on obscure presidents that most people would probably fail a quiz on when they were even president.
Yes.
And then you jumped to the great one, Ulysses Grant. You skipped over Buchanan and Lincoln and Johnson on the way.
Right. Not necessarily by choice, but the editor of the series had already assigned those two. And, I got the fascinating figures of Millard Fillmore and Franklin Pierce. I wasn't, thrilled by that, but I did it because it was, you know, when you're in academia, you have to have some publishing accomplishments. So I took that on, and then it was kind of a last minute thing. Whoever was assigned to do Ulysses Grant bailed out, and so it was offered to me because they were hesitant because they didn't want me doing three presidents in a series.
Okay.
But they got a little desperate, and I was able to oblige them, so I did it.
Now, I can't imagine that there might be a kind of pleasure in writing about obscure presidents because you're kind of charting your own ground. You know, like when you write about a famous president, there's so many sources you don't even know where to start and stop. Right?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Yes. And I was able to do some on-site local archival research. Mm-hmm. And it also gave me a grant from the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh Development Fund, which filled in for salary droughts that occurred during the summer in academia because we're on a 9-month salary structure. So it was helpful, and it also paid for a few trips, and I usually link them in with some pleasure, fun, you know,
so, like,
while
with,
I was
with,
out there.
With Fillmore, did you go to Buffalo? And Pierce, you went to, was it New Hampshire?
Yes, Concord, New Hampshire, yeah. Which was his hometown, and it's the capital, and it's where the historical museum is, mm-hmm. or the library there. Yeah, so I enjoyed that.
And Buffalo is a great town. And what's his name? Cleveland's from there, too. Two presidents,
yes,
from Buffalo.
Yes, yeah. Very good. Mm-hmm. Grover Cleveland, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I did see their statuary. Of course, covering Miller, I'll have to say this between the two, covering Millard Fillmore, frankly, he was so boring that, you
You're
know,
really
I was glad, I'm really glad I did not have a handgun near me because I might have used it on myself when I was dealing with
you
them.
You are really selling this book. People
no,
are gonna,
I know, no.
Stop listening and run to the bookstore to get your Millard
well,
Fillmore.
Well, the mortgage, you know, the marketing strategy for this series was such that they were really looking to make this, the whole series from Washington to Obama at the time,
yeah,
as a library reference.
Right.
And so the price of the books was sky high, and I couldn't in good conscience try to plug them.
Okay. And did you have to buy the set? You couldn't buy them?
No, no. I mean, I wrote them, and yeah, and people could buy each individual if
okay.
they wanted, but they were just wacky priced.
Yeah.
So I gave up with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I made nothing off of this. The only book I have to date made any money on was my first one, the one on George McClellan. So,
and that's a good teaser. We're less than a minute away from our first break, and we're gonna tease that book. The headline is George B. McClellan and Civil War History. The subtitle is a little more exciting: In the Shadows of Grant and Sherman. And we'll get to that on the other side of the break.
I'm telling these tears going fall away, oh, may the last one burn into flame. Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
The Maggie Dawn Show is back. I am your guest host, Nick Kovac. I'm joined by my guest, while guest hosting, Professor Thomas Rowland. We made it through his three presidential biographies. We're now going to quickly mention that his most recent book, which I have on loan from the owner of Black Husky, Tim Eichinger.
Yes, you need to go out and buy it, huh?
Yeah, I do. I do need to. I've acquired my own of your first book. I wanted to make sure I liked this one before I bought the next one. Great inscription here to Tim. I think you said, Tim, I gave you this because you're one of the people who might read it. Patriotism is a Catholic virtue. Irish American Catholics and the Church in the Era of the Great War, 1900 to 1918.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
And that one is a little more exciting than Millard Fillmore, I would imagine, especially for a lot of, you know, whether you're Irish or not, the big Irish community in Milwaukee.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, well, you know, and also, you know, it sells in New York and Boston and
I can imagine,
Philadelphia, yeah, and other more Irish American cities.
But you're saying this one doesn't sell as well as your history book?
Well, it's only been out since November of last year, uh-huh, and I actually did get a report from the publisher that I do have already accumulated a royalty. I don't know exactly when it's going to be sent.
Okay. So more than the $0 you got from the presidential biography.
Exactly. Yes.
And then the book that was a selection in the late 90s, your first published book of the history book. And actually, I bought it, you know, through the evil corporate internet media source.
Right.
It's inscribed from someone in North Carolina, and they bought it in November of 2000 as a History Book Club selection. That's the inscription.
Right.
And I think I mentioned it before. And this book is kind of, this is our MacGuffin or our hook or really the beginning of the longer conversation I plan on having on air today about the parallels between 2024 election and 1864 election. Because the remarkable thing for people who don't know who George B. McClellan is and haven't had time to Google him since I told you the title of this book in the last segment, he was a West Point grad. He was a general. He wasn't the first, but he was the most, well, he might have been, was he the first general of the Army of the Potomac?
Well, of the Army of the Potomac, because in the previous collection of troops that marched out to Bull Run in July of 1861, it didn't have that title.
Mm-hmm. Right, retitled it.
Yeah, and it was led by Irvin McDowell. Of course, it was a disaster, and as a result of that, McClellan was called out of West Virginia, where he had some minor victories, and so he is the creator, the organizer, and so forth of the Army of the Potomac, the Eastern Army.
And if we have time in the second half of the show, we'll get into what happened while he was leading the Army of the Potomac, because it's really the main topic of the book. And the book doesn't really touch on the thing that arguably he might be, I don't know if he's more famous for. It's something that I find more remarkable and interesting as maybe more of a political than a military guy, that he was one of those generals that decided to run for president. But he might be the only general that ran against his former boss.
Yes, yes. And I will, hopefully, we'll cram it in there.
Yeah.
where, you know, he's an unlikely candidate, but then he's a very likely candidate because of his, military career and his, differences, mm-hmm. let's say, with the Lincoln administration. So he was a good standard bearer.
Right. And arguably Lincoln fired him mostly for, in Lincoln's opinion and in the opinion of, in Lincoln's opinion and other opinions, him maybe being a bad general, although your book tries to not completely disagree with that assessment, but say he wasn't maybe as bad as some people say. Is that fair?
That's basically what I wanted to do. It was not a revision, mm-hmm. Book per se, but it was like to gain a little bit more of a balanced perspective. And, well, if we get around to the book, maybe we need to meet back again, a few months, and I'll be willing to talk about the book, but or the Packers, whatever you prefer.
Yeah. But he did, anyway, he did end up running against Lincoln for Lincoln's re-election in 1864, and somewhat on a platform of, do we need to keep fighting this war, right? Like, I didn't win it, and nobody can win it. This war isn't worth winning, and certainly slavery isn't worth ending, was implicit, even explicit in his campaign, correct?
Yes, but I mean, that varied very differently from the other part, of the Democratic Party in that election, which was the so-called Peace Party, mm-hmm. or dubbed maliciously as the Copperheads, mm-hmm. Who wrote a peace platform with no conditions, mm-hmm. Meaning that if the South wanted to go its way, they'd be fine with it. Actually, this sort of steals a little bit of when I come up to the election, but basically, McClellan was chosen because they had to have a figure of some notoriety, mm-hmm. and someone whose opposition to Lincoln was pretty pronounced. So they did select him, but McClellan was a war Democrat, mm-hmm. and that is, he rejected the Democratic platform of 1864.
Mm-hmm.
That was drafted by the Copperheads or the Peace Democrats. So he rejected it immediately and stridently. But he was all for restoring the Union. And if the restoration of the Union was incumbent upon other issues, mm-hmm. i.e. the Emancipation Proclamation, the freeing of the slaves, he was clearly for that. This would have, even if he had pulled out a victory and tried to do that, that would simply kick the ball down the road, because then, we might be united again. But the same issue about the expansion of slavery, would continue to bubble
up. It would have been Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, and James Buchanan all over again.
Yeah, a couple of them were in their graves, or at least, by then.
But I just mean kicking the can down the road.
Exactly.
A house divided cannot stand, but we're going to try to keep it up on stilts with duct tape.
Yeah, so it was unrealistic in a way, but he wanted to make a definitive thing that he was not. He understood that soldiers, hundreds of thousands of them now had died by 1864. And, you know, he was not going to turn his back on that. And he also believed firmly in the Union.
Would it be a fair comparison to make the war and the peace Democrats between maybe the two fractions of the factions of the Republican Party in 2024 in their opinions on Ukraine and Putin?
I think you could make that kind of, you know, parallel. Again,
it's different because it's not a civil war. It's halfway around
right.
the world, but it is standing up to a moral evil, you know, Putin's moral evil of his authoritarianism and disrespect for civil rights of his own people and the lives of his opponents. Is that comparable to American slavery? Nothing really is, but it's a moral evil either way. Yeah.
Yes. No, that I would concur with clearly, you know. Who was it, George Santayana, you know, with the famous thing, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, if you don't learn from the lessons of the past, you will repeat them.
Doomed to repeat it.
Yeah, doomed to repeat it. But, you know, that's a fallacy as well, because, yeah, no situation, you know, down the road is the same, you know, in its dimensions, its character, its time. In history.
That's a great tease for what we're going to get into. The meat of our conversation will start at the end of the next segment, folks. We're going to talk about, is 2024 unprecedented? And I think you can probably guess that the answer is no. And we're going to talk about how we got to that 1864 election that we just started talking about. How did we get there?
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on.
John Brown's body was put into the grave in 1859. He was hung by, I think, James Buchanan. Or might it was Robert E. Lee involved in that?
Yes. Yes, yes. He commanded the group of Marines that left from the barracks in Washington, came out by train, and he led the attack on the arsenal where John Brown was held up. Jeb Stuart actually is the one that battered down the doors of the arsenal. But
and
Stonewall Jackson was there as well for the hanging.
Famous Confederate officers, but they were obviously fighting for the not yet seceded Union at the time. And everybody agreed that John Brown needed to be hung, that he was a terrorist and what he did was wrong.
Right. He had, yes.
From Lincoln to Seward. And some people even say that's the reason Lincoln became president, because they thought Seward was too extreme, potentially.
Yes, yes. Lincoln's more moderate stance on things was consistent, and, you know, I don't know whether we can spend a whole lot on his views, but we'll try to insert it.
Again, I keep getting off track because I got distracted by that great song, but we're going to get to John Brown, and we'll talk about how in the world did someone who everybody agreed should be murdered by the state end up being the hero of a conquering army 5 years later, and they're singing the song John Brown's Body, even though it was actually a different John Brown that the song was written for. By the time they were singing it, they were thinking of, I think most of them were probably thinking of the John Brown who invaded Harper's Ferry and also had done some definitely illegal and violent things in Bleeding Kansas a few years before.
Right.
But, and so actually I kind of started answering my own question perhaps, but the question I really want to organize the show around, and it was your idea, Professor Roland, is so many people, especially people who have, which most people that are alive today have only been around since the mid 20th century, pretty much. And I think since the mid 20th century, maybe if you use the Eisenhower on period, maybe it's unprecedented since then, the level of open division.
I think that's a good point. Yeah.
But, you know, the mid-20th century is only a slight fraction of our country's overall history. We've had the same general organizing rules, the same constitution since 1789. So is the rhetoric that Trump and Vance and Mike Johnson are using and the sort of revanchist Republican Party, the new Republican Party, the post-Trump Republican Party. Is that rhetoric that open? And arguably, I think Scott Walker was using it earlier when he demonized teachers and professors like yourself. I would argue that it started before Trump, but Trump certainly put a lot of frosting on the cake.
Definitely, yes. And I, you know, it certainly is by our standards of today. This is a very vitriolic and, argumentative and, you know, destructive kind of dialogue that's going on in this. But it's hardly unprecedented. And frankly, it's not exceptional. You know, and I'll be real quick here.
Go right ahead.
You can go back to the colonial era, and there was tension between those who lived in the interior and the elites who lived along the coast. Mm-hmm. There were several riots or outbreaks. The Revolutionary War itself, when you've got 25% of the population loyalist, maybe 35% who were patriotic, and the rest who were somewhere in between, indifferent. But, you know, if you look at the Southern campaign, this is where you have... the Revolutionary War. The loyalists and patriots were raping and killing and burning homes and destructive. It was a general civil war within the Revolutionary War. The constitutional debate became very inflamed. Federalists versus anti-federalists. Then of course you have,
and when you say inflamed, you don't just mean like, thoughtful debates about technical, bureaucratic details. Like it was personal attacks, nasty.
Yes. Ad hominem attacks. I mean, they were just commonplace. And then you go through the rest of, American history. You can point out, you know, tense times, you know, the Depression and, the entry of the United States into two world wars. I mean, so there was a lot of that. And as you say, you know, when you get to Eisenhower, you know, there's kind of a respite from that kind of dynamic. But you can't pass over the Civil War. I mean, that in itself is a description of, an intense political climate.
Right, and the Civil War didn't just come from nowhere.
Exactly. And there is a build-up to that that kind of a climate. And if you're up for it, I thought maybe just a quick... I'm trying to make it quick.
It doesn't need to be quick. We got more than an hour left. Let's talk about how did the Civil War happen, you know, the context for it.
And I think, I think a lot of, as a historian and, you know, knowing colleagues and so forth, we're tempted half the time to go in the background back to Adam and Eve, to sort of draw up. But I'll bring it up to the Mexican War, the war with Mexico, 1846, and then the treaty in 1848.
Sometimes called Polk's War, even though it happened after he was president.
It happened during his term. He had pledged not to run a second term. Probably very good, because within a year of exiting the White House, he died. Okay. So, but the war with Mexico and the escalation in the political climate, and I mean that in its broadest sense, involving culture and traditions and economics and all things. So, but basically under the umbrella of political contention. And politics, if I could just say in a very broad sense, you know, politics is power. And I think I may actually, this is my original quote, but I'm sure someone else said it. But power is, you know, the ability to advance your agenda, your interest, your policy, and the power to deflect those who are in opposition. And so it's an important thing. And that very much was going on in the 1850s and, you know, even extending into the war itself. But if you would, you know, the thing that comes up is the treaty was in 1848, but it sort of set there. But the big question that would come up that would need resolution is, all of those new territories that were gained in the treaty, and they were immense, would they be open to slavery or would they be barred from the introduction of slavery?
And that treaty did give what we now know as most of the present state of Texas, as well as the Oregon Territory and California, all came over in that treaty.
Right. And large parts of what we consider parts of Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, all of that is transferred. And the big question was, well, when they do get developed and prepared, what would happen?
A lot of historians that I've read say that the Alamo myth notwithstanding, the poor settlers that were supposedly being persecuted by the Mexican government. A lot of historians I've read have said that it really was just Americans, especially Southern Americans, wanted opportunity to expand slavery. That's why they wanted Texas so bad.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that was the understanding. For example, the one-year term that Abraham Lincoln was elected to Congress as a Whig from Illinois, he was one who opposed the war.
And Ulysses Grant fought in the war and later said it was a bad war to fight.
Yes, but that's, you know, hindsight in a way. And also he's a military figure, whereas Lincoln,
he had to follow orders. Yeah.
Yeah. And Lincoln saw through it, as did most Northerners, and especially those who were adamant about corralling slavery, keeping it where it would be with the hope that it would eat itself, basically, and phase out. Mm-hmm. But the issue came up in 1850 when California, on the heels of Wisconsin, wanted to enter into
Wisconsin, the great state of Wisconsin, and you're listening to Civic Media Radio throughout the state of Wisconsin, 1848, two years after Milwaukee became a city. So don't forget that, Wisconsin. The city of Milwaukee is 2 years older than the state. But
yeah, there you go. they did, and of course they had the population requisite to seek because of the gold rush in 1849. Mm-hmm. They're ready. Yeah. And they insisted on entering into the Union based on barring slavery.
California did.
Yeah, right.
And Wisconsin had to be because of the Northwest Territory document.
Well, yes.
Or was at least inclined that way already.
So. Right, right. Californians, wanted that, and they rallied around what was known as free soil. Mm-hmm. Now, lest you think that is somehow very liberal and advanced on the racial issue, you'd be very wrong. Mm-hmm. It was a free soil party. They did run a candidate, Martin Van Buren, 1848. He did not do well. But these free soilers.
Former president Martin Van Buren.
Yes,
prior
exactly.
President running again on a different party.
Yeah, yes. Basically, they did very poorly. The Southerners were incensed about that because, again, politics is power. What would happen? That balance that they had been able to keep throughout the earlier republic up until 1850, one free state gets admitted, a Southern state gets admitted.
This went back to the Missouri Compromise of 1860.
Exactly.
And when you say balance, you literally mean numerical balance of the number of senators.
Right.
50-50.
Right. And under that, Southerners had enjoyed tremendous power because they always had a number of Northern Democrats who would basically side with them in political, contests, as it were. And this would call for what emerged was the Compromise of 18. The free soil thing was free soil and opportunity for white men. Mm-hmm. The gold rush was there, and a lot of Californians, did not want to envision young slave owners coming out with their 20 slaves and mining the fields in competition with them.
Mm-hmm.
So in
a lot of ways, the anti-slavery movement was also awfully and differently, but awfully racist.
Yes.
Because they were basically like, we don't want black people here at all.
Right.
And in fact, Illinois had barred free blacks, didn't they, during Lincoln's time? Right, I think they barred immigration of blacks into Illinois for a long time.
Yes, a number of northern states did that. Southern states eventually refused to allow them you know, even if you were free, they wouldn't allow you to move north. So, but that's a complex matter. But basically, the Compromise of 1850, California, I mean, there were five provisions, but the two that were most important is Southerners conceded California would be non-slave. The big consolation prize, as it was, the passage of the Fugitive Slave Law, which we talked earlier about, and that is, there had always been one on the books.
And it's in the Constitution.
It's in the Constitution.
It's since been implicitly repealed by the 13th Amendment, but it's in, for all you originalists, Scalia, Thomas out there, if you really love the original founders and think they were perfect, the awful Fugitive Slave Law that led to the Dred Scott decision, that led to the Civil War, clearly racist, clearly awful. You know, James Madison put that right in the document.
Right. Yes. So it had been there, but it had been largely ignored in the North. This one was supposed to be ironclad.
Yeah.
But
it was a it was actually a legislative repetition of a constitutional principle, but it, sometimes the which arguably the Civil Rights Law of 1964 was actually just a rewriting of the Civil Rights Law of 1868. But there's something about passing it recently that sort of indicates, hey, I really mean this. Yeah. We're coming up on the next break. We also have Mark from Prairie du Sac, who's got a quote. Maybe we'll get to him in the next segment. He's got a quote about the Enlightenment and secession. We'll hear from you when we get back, and then we'll continue our journey from 1850. Are we going to get to 1864 before the top of the hour? We'll find out.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath is stored. He's loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on.
Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm Nick Kovac talking with Thomas Rowland, and we had just left off with the legislative repassing of a constitutional provision commonly known as the Fugitive Slave Law, and I think there's some modern parallels to this that I want to get to after Professor Rowland tells us about the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, and even it had an effect on Milwaukee.
Yes, you know, again, much like pre 1850, Northerners just didn't see any investment in, for themselves in collaborating and cooperating with slave catchers sent up from the South. And so they were routinely ignored, and in some cases, slave catchers coming up were bruised, bruised quite a bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, just using one example of many here in Milwaukee, the case of Joshua Glover, who was apprehended off near a farm in Racine because Racine was so abolitionist, the sheriffs brought him to Milwaukee, where the sentiment, it was understood, was not quite so abolitionist. And they put him in the county jail.
Which is current site of Cathedral Square Park.
Exactly. Yeah. And there is a historical marker on the park on sort of the northeast corner of the park telling the tale of Joshua Glover. Local abolitionists, particularly Sherman Booth, you know, rallied the crowds. They broke down the jail. You know, you read this a lot in the mid-19th century where jails get, you know, smashed to bits. I don't know how it's done exactly. But they spring them. They make an arrangement. He is shuttled on by the Underground Railroad by, you know, fleeing to Canada by Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. But there's an example. And Southerners by 1854, when this happened, feel as though they have been, you know, conned, as it were. That's a very important description that's being used in current political dialogue.
That the law was being ignored.
Yeah, the law was being ignored.
by Sherman Booth in particular. And actually, you mentioned that where it actually happened, there's a marker. Do you know about near our favorite watering hole, 3 blocks from our favorite watering hole, is a street named after Sherman Booth?
Exactly. And there's another one, Glover.
And that was renamed by the current Common Council member, Alderwoman Malele Coggs, who I went to elementary high school with and served with for 14 years. She's still serving in the Common Council. And she led the charge to rename that little stretch a reservoir where it intersects with Booth, with the beautiful view of the city right near Kadish Park.
Yes.
She led the charge as a high school student to get that renamed after Joshua Glover.
Oh, very good. Yeah, and it explains that, you know, they may have named Booth Avenue at an earlier period.
Yes, yeah,
it was fine to mention, you know, a white abolitionist, but it probably took, you know, to a more contemporary mm-hmm. period before you could get
before you could do that.
All right.
Even in the North, even in the abolitionist North, racism was strong.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Let me see if I can get through
Go right
this.
Ahead.
But
yeah.
Anyway, 1854 is a big date. It's the signing of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Mm-hmm. And basically, these were the territories that were next in line for settlement and then eventual statehood. Now, the Kansas-Nebraska Act separated Nebraska. Southerners knew there was no likelihood of having slavery up there, but Kansas...
Now, was that mainly because of climate or because of
mostly
sentiment?
Climate.
Mostly climate.
Yeah, yeah, and there was such sparse settlement in the area that we would kind of call the Nebraska Territory. In fact, there wasn't that much in Kansas, mm-hmm. but Democratic Senator... Stephen A. Douglas
of Illinois
was very interested in making Chicago the terminus for Transcontinental Railroad going west, and it would go through Kansas. So he lobbied the government, Alexander Stevens, who would become
the vice president of the Confederacy.
Very good. I feel like I'm going to have to give you a couple gold stars on your desk here for excellence. But in any event...
Was he also the grandfather of Lucius Clay, Eisenhower's logistics guy? He might have been. Let me double check that. I'll double check that.
Yeah, but in any event, he rallied the House of Representatives, yep. and then Franklin Pierce signed off on it. And it basically was the concept of popular sovereignty. Mm-hmm. The people who settled in there would ultimately make the decision. Of course, and I can't go over the long history, but bleeding Kansas became an epithet for what transpired between 1854.
Speaking of popular sovereignty, sounds like a great concept. Let the people decide. Well, in America, not that long ago, I mean, nobody was alive then who's alive today, but less than 200 years ago, popular sovereignty meant mass violence
right.
on both sides.
Right, right. And that's what. That's what happened. I mean, you have the sacking of Lawrence by the so-called Missouri border ruffians, and then you had John Brown marching through Pottawatomie Creek, you know, mm-hmm. massacring five what he understood to be pro-slave sympathetic folks.
They weren't even slave owners, right? They were just slave sympathizers.
No, yeah, right. Yeah. And then it just spiraled out of control. And it wasn't until the outbreak of the Civil War before Kansas just got exhausted and, sort of lay on the side. But that's not that important. But what happened there is really a dress rehearsal for the Civil War. And it led, shortly after the passage of that act in 1854, disillusioned Whigs, who now understood that the Whigs were totally, unable to affect political policy anymore. And it's really the death of the Whigs. But out of those ashes, in a small meeting in Ripon, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. in a schoolhouse, a group of concerned citizens inflamed over the passage of that act began the genesis of the Republican Party.
The original Republican Party.
Right.
Which came out of the Whigs and the Free Soilers. And and Lincoln was a Whig before he was a Republican.
Right. Whigs will gravitate to that, Free Soilers and nativists, which mm-hmm. is...
Yeah, we should maybe get into that in the next segment. We only have a few seconds left here. We've been discussing what is sometimes called the long 19th century. I hope listeners don't agree that it's been too long of a talk about it. We've only covered a couple, barely a decade of the long 19th century, stretching from the Revolutionary War to the First World War. And we're going to talk more about it with it, and we're going to get up to the middle of the Civil War, and again, keep making comparisons to where we are now today in 2024. There's an election then that's not so different from an election now. I mean, quite different, but certainly parallels can be drawn.
You'd had your fill. This is not a test, it's not a drill. Take no